Well, with the May 14th budget looming, the country is halfway through the 12-week government wage subsidy, which so far has paid out over $10.5 billion to nearly 1.75 New Zealanders to keep them connected to their employer in the hope that they can return to work as alert levels are lowered. Treasury's most optimistic scenario for the economy is a 4.5% drop in GDP, with unemployment doubling to 10%. In the first 4 weeks of lockdown, 33,000 more people went on the unemployment benefit, meaning 5.8% of the working age population is now receiving job seeker support, up 1 percentage point on a month ago. Already there are predictions that the end of the wage subsidy scheme will see a new wave of redundancies at the end of next month. The Finance Minister, Grant Robertson, will deliver his third budget next week. What measures can he produce to address the scale of the economic crisis and to try to turn things around? To discuss, our guests are Cameron Bagri, independent economist. Morning, Cameron. Can you hear me?
Yep, good as gold.
Great, welcome. Eric Crampton is chief economist of the think tank, the New Zealand Initiative. Hello, Eric.
Good morning.
And Andy Hamilton is former chief executive of the business incubator The Ice House, now director of its investment arm and co-founder of the small business support platform Manaaki. Good morning to you, Andy.
Morena, Catherine.
Cameron, can we start with you and just set the scene here for the scale of what has happened to the economy? How do you give the overview of the impact of the last 5 weeks, actually a bit more, but certainly the last 5 weeks? Where are we at?
Well, I don't use this term lightly, but it's an absolute disaster. You know, people are thinking about this through a GDP lens. They're not thinking about this through a total income hit. If I have a look at the sales and income across the business sector in New Zealand, and New Zealand is a $700 billion turnover a year economy. So divide that by 12, you get about $60 billion a month. Now, if you look at Treasury's working assumption at alert level 4, 40% of the economy's shut down. Yeah, 40% of 60 is about $25 billion. Yeah, we're now at alert level 3. The government says about 25% of the economy is shut down. My personal view is it's actually more than that, but yeah, 25% of $60 billion, well, there's another 15. Yeah, so in the space of these sort of 2 months, you're talking a $40 billion hit, and what we know is that we're not going rushing back to freedom. There's going to be economic costs at alert level 2 and alert level 1. Now, this thing is going to add up. The brutal reality is that firms are running out of cash. The cash bleed is only really now just starting. Firms in April were getting paid for work done in March. Firms haven't worked in April. They're not going to get paid in May or June, even if they're back on a construction site in May, invoice at the end of May, well, you might get paid by the middle of July. Now, the cash bleed out there is just immense.
Let's look at the flow-on effects of that. What is your take on unemployment and where it will get to?
Well, unemployment's going to be double-digit. Now, you forget about the global financial crisis or the Asian crisis as a benchmark. If I have a look at the numbers at the moment in regard to who's on the job seeker benefit, it looks to me as of today, and we're talking early May, the unemployment rate is around 6.5%. And I don't think we've seen anything yet. The government's done the right thing with the wage subsidy scheme, trying to buy a little bit of time. Are we going to need that wage subsidy scheme extended in the budget? The answer is yes, into the third quarter of the year. But the reality for a lot of businesses is if you're not getting turnover, you can't pay the bills. And the businesses are going to be making some pretty tough decisions, I suspect, in the next 1 to 2 weeks, because that wage subsidy rolls off in early June.
Let's look at the budget, and we need to look at through the immediate emergency lens and then that little bit further out, obviously, even with the moves on the RMA, beginning to look at how you might be able to inject some life. But let's look at what could be featuring or should be featuring, if not in next week's budget, then fairly soon. Cameron, stay with the wage subsidy scheme. For all its imperfections, do you believe it remains part of trying to keep businesses, viable businesses, on life support?
Yes. But my personal view is that I'd probably tweak it. a little bit. You know, I'd actually take the numerical payment up to be in line with the minimum wage, but I'd make it a loan as opposed to a handout. And so it becomes a little bit more skin in the game from both sides. You know, the government is going to be handing out more money, you know, so there's more of an incentive for businesses to hold in there, you know, particularly the tourism and hospitality sector, if they're going to be able to fork out the minimum wage. Let's get it up around that sort of level, but you make it a loan as opposed to a physical cash payment.
If you're looking at the immediate support for businesses, again, that are presumed to be viable once there is some sort of return to normal, what else should be in there? We still haven't seen anything solid on things like rental costs, although we have seen a loan scheme targeting fixed costs, but pretty much targeted at small businesses and pretty limited, Cameron.
Well, there's been a whole lot of moving parts, and some stuff has been more successful than others. Yeah, the wage subsidy's been pretty successful, despite, in my personal view, a few firms have been out there sort of taking the mickey, and I hope they get exposed in regard to that. Yeah, the government did the right thing, stepping up to the plate with a business lending facility. Yeah, there were probably a few too many holes in that, so that money hasn't actually gone through into the business community. The banks are blaming Treasury, the government's blaming the banks. The government's came out with a new facility aimed at getting your money into small businesses' pockets, you know, $10,000 up front, $1,800 per employee up to $100,000, sort of all up. But you've got to step back here and just have a look at the scale of the numbers in regard to, you know, what's going on. You know, once again, there's 500,000 businesses across New Zealand that turn over less than 50 million. Now, the majority of these firms had turnover actually less than a million, but the turnover across that set is about 400 billion. Yeah, so, in all honesty, you're getting a $10,000 lending facility. If you've got turnover, you know, in excess of 1 to 5 million, there's 50,000 firms in that bracket. If you look at the number of firms that are turnover between 100,000 and a million, there's 200,000 firms in that bracket. Yeah, $10,000 is going to go whistling out the door pretty quick if you're not making sales at all in the month.
So do you, just looking at this immediate business support focus, do you see anything different, or ought there be anything different?
Well, I guess if I were to look at it in spirit, yeah, what are we going to need in the second half of this year? We're going to need more central government support. Yeah, and it's not just central government we need to be looking at. Yeah, obviously, yeah, commercial landlords here are expected to take a little bit of a hit if your landlord can't pay the rent. Residential property investors, you take the hit if your tenant can't pay the rent. Yeah, the Reserve Bank is stepping up to the plate and throwing the kitchen sink of this thing. Yeah, we're asking the banks to be courageous. Yeah, I'd like to see local government stepping up to the plate as well. But there's a pretty simple philosophy in regard to what needs to go on. Is that the big needs to be supporting the small. Yeah, big companies, big entities, big organisations, big sectors, central government, local government, they've got access to capital. Yeah, they've got access to capital markets. Yeah, they've got the ability to ride through the cash squeeze. Yeah, small businesses, medium-sized businesses do not have that accessibility to deep, well-heeled capital markets. And that's where we've got the real fundamental problem at the moment, because they are bleeding cash and they do not have that cash to bleed. And they're facing some pretty tough decisions in regard to whether they can continue in the second half of this year, let alone 2021. So this is not a V-shaped recovery. Now, this is a U or an L. Yeah, we're going to go down through the alert levels, but boy, there's going to be a tough grind on the other side. Yeah, for a lot of businesses, yeah, the sales line is not going back to what it was pre-COVID-19. Yeah, they're facing a fundamental reset with the environment. It's going to be a tougher environment. What does that mean? Firms need to reset their cost line to be more in line with the different sales line. Yeah, what does that mean? Well, people are going to be cutting costs. What's the biggest cost? Well, one of the biggest costs is labour costs.
Okay. Andy Hamilton, can I bring you in here, former Chief Executive of the Business Incubator, the Ice House, now Director of its investment arm, and as we said, co-founder of the small business support platform, Manaaki. Do you want to pick up on this idea that it's not just government, and we'll talk more about the Reserve Bank in a moment as well, that it is other branches of the country that have got to step up here? Could you explain what you are doing with the support platform and who it is you believe needs to get involved?
Yeah, so look, a couple of things there. I'd say we founded Menaki just because we wanted to collapse the advice time it takes for small businesses to get the best quality advice from the likes of advisors, lawyers, accountants, property people, so that they could get an instant bit of guidance and they could go on with the rest of their life, which is 10 or 20 other things that have that are challenged in every day. And Menaki's really resonated because you've got heads of HR from Vector, Auckland Council and ACC who are actually helping small businesses. Cameron's really right, though. Here's the thing. There is a, you know, there is a material cash crunch that's happening to these businesses that have to make their decision really about a second wave of redundancy in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And so that worries me. But here's the thing. The government can't wear this alone. And the challenge is we've had banks on the one hand being really good with their existing customers and on the other hand being really challenging around any new type of lending. So that's a problem. Landlords, some being great, some being, you know, pretty average. And so I think I kind of look at it as two waves. We're in the, I think we're in the end of survival and flatlining phase. And out of that will be the revival phase. But that feels a long, long way away. And it's just the scale is immense. I've struggled because all my calls when I talk to owners, you know, there are still some people who are doing well out there. It's just the contagion of people who don't have the ability to earn revenue. And that's what we've got to work through without the government having to write check after check after check, because we can't survive by doing that.
Well, then how do you do it? If there remains a cash crunch, if there remains subdued income for a substantial point of part of time and you're a smaller business, what are the options?
Well, one of the things I sort of posted last week was is that if everyone gave 20% or 25%, including employees, including, you know, the owners are giving more and all the key suppliers, actually for a $250 up to a $2 million business, they could actually get through. That cash subsidy with the IRD last week, that's going to make a difference. I would love to see the Business Finance Guarantee Scheme being more fit for purpose. It's not fit for purpose. I understand why the banks are not lending, but I just want the banks and the Reserve Bank and Treasury to get over it and sort out a fit for purpose scheme. And then we've just got to find a way for these businesses to get back in revenue flow to get them through. And we are going to have to accept there is going to be a truckload of failure.
What's happening with the banks and that business guarantee that was announced right at the outset of the lockdown, actually? And it's big money. Just remind me, it's...
$6 billion.
Yeah, but just for the individual businesses, your turnover's what? It's, is it 80 million plus, isn't it?
No, it's between 250,000, I think, up to 80 million
up to 80
turnover.
Million. Why, the is, whole that, idea why is that not, apparently, not working as it ought?
It's just not fit for purpose. I think that it's, you know, personal guarantees, one, security requirements, the interest rate measures. But in the end, you've got Treasury and the banks both saying it's each other's fault and no money's going out the door. So it's just a failed policy. And the question is, do we need to change it? Yes, if, you know, because Cameron's right, like a 10 or 20 or 30 grand business loan from the IRD is going to make a difference to a small business. But a 5, 10, 20, 40 million dollar business, 100 grand makes no difference. You know, they actually need sizable amounts of cash flow support to be able to get through. And I think that's the challenge, you know, because these businesses will get back if they can start earning revenue. It's just a question of what we do in the meantime while they're trying to catch up. And I think one really important thing is we have to turn this away from all the businesses ringing their landlord, their ACC, the IRD, the bank, to something being way more systematic and automated so that people can get going. Because people just, you know, you can't make 20 phone calls a day that you're in the crap. You need to be able to find a way to turn it around.
Do you have any ideas on that in the speed that is required?
I just think we just need more cash flowing in the system. If that comes from revenue, great. If that comes from more policies, if that comes from the banks having a more fit-for-purpose lending, you know, if they're not prepared to lend because of the risk, change the risk question. Or, you know, one of the ideas is that we recapitalise as a nation Kiwibank and we just basically pile the money into that and then say, right, we'll do fit-for-purpose lending to get the money out the door. Got to find a way. The thing I liked about the IRD lending, even with the risk, is it's actually a loan, so there is a chance of turning that money back in time instead of just writing lots and lots of checks, because in the end, it'll be too costly for New Zealand.
The IRD one is the one that was accidentally passed in the House last week, right?
Attached
to another bill, and it is a lending scheme, not the same as, but with similar characteristics to a student loan scheme, but again, quite small sums. Eric Crampton, can I bring you in on this first part of our conversation, which is the immediate needs now? Chief Economist of the Think Tank New Zealand Initiative, your views on this budget or any other day, actually, in the next few weeks. What else would sustain businesses that have a future?
The absolute most important thing that the government needs to have in the budget is making sure that the Ministry of Health and the district health boards are scaled up to be able to do contact tracing and testing to be able to get us to level two, to stay no worse than level two for the foreseeable future. We can't afford to have more lockdowns the way that we have had, and making sure that we have the public health capacity to trace all the contacts of any cases that come up very, very quickly, put them all into rigorous quarantine to make sure we never get into the spot again. That has to be the most important. All of the business support, that's also very important. We've got some ideas around that. But if we go into lockdown again because we've had another outbreak, this starts becoming just impossibly expensive for the country. It's bigger than the government can afford, bigger than any of us can afford. It's going to be just real misery. So it's nickel and dime stuff in the grand scheme of things. Getting contact tracing up, you're talking, it can't be more than the tens of millions. And here we're talking about bailout schemes that are in the billions. Getting this right so that we're not seeing headline stories about it taking them a month to track down a contact from a flight, making sure that that can't happen again by scaling them up so that it works. That has to be most important. Once we have that in place, we can start looking at areas where we can start building our way out of this. So Taiwan is already in very good shape. I really hope that we're talking with Taiwan about some mutual assurance about our contact tracing regimes and our testing regimes and our response, so that we can trust each other to have open borders between the two, so that there doesn't need to be a quarantine period for travel between those two. And then thinking about adding South Korea to that, because they're doing a fantastic job in keeping COVID in check there. The more that we can do to have trade links reestablished, business travel reestablished, and tourism reestablished among places that are comparably safe, the faster we can get out of this and the less we have to be worried about government supporting business and government supporting families, because we're going to be able to be back to work. Part of that, similarly, we should be thinking about other opportunities that our new lifeboat status might be providing. We've all been seeing the fantastic international press that New Zealand has been getting because of the strength of our response and our ability to drive those curves down. Every week we're seeing the Financial Times coming out with their little curves that look like that big tsunami wave, right? And you've got the bits where New Zealand keeps pushing down the bottom of that axis because our case numbers are so low. Everybody knows that we're a lifeboat. Why not open the door to foreign students again with appropriate quarantine measures? So we're looking possibly at another big bailout for the universities. We don't have to do that. If we found a way of making sure that the medical officers of health could certify quarantine facilities so that foreign students could come back in, all of a sudden we've got piles of people who would be coming in, doing a bit of tourism activity, supporting the hospitality sector. We'd need to make sure that the quarantine facilities are rigorous, that the medical officers of health are not just signing off on these things, but also monitoring to make sure that practices are good so we aren't importing bad stuff. But where other tourists coming from red zone places, we'll separate between red zone and green zone. Red zone is like the America, the UK, most of Europe, that just has not gotten a proper handle on their messes and are unlikely to in the foreseeable future. Green zone would be more like us, potentially Australia, Taiwan, definitely they're ahead of us, South Korea, where we should be able to get to having quarantine-free travel. Tourists from red zone places aren't going to put up with a two-week quarantine. They're not going to come in. but students coming in for a semester or a year or 3 years of study, 2 weeks as a dawdle, they'd be able to come in, and not only would we not be needing to bail out the universities, they would be helping to support other industries. We've been locked in a fair bit of deficit thinking, we could call it, around the need to looking around in the hole that we're in rather than trying to figure out the areas that we can grow in so that it won't be quite as bad.
Thank you, Cameron Bagri, Eric Crampton and Andy Hamilton are our guests. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National, 28 minutes past 9 it is. Well, speaking with deficits, let's talk about the debt that's being run up and some of the, well, they would be regarded as less conventional mechanisms that we could see either in this budget or more likely beyond. The fundamentals of our economic system are being rethought or challenged in many ways. Cameron, can I come back to you? I want to just hear from each of you some of the areas you think we should be rethinking the status quo. We've seen the Reserve Bank Governor talking about debt now, and already, of course, is into quantitative easing. The Reserve Bank already standing by to buy up government debt in the form of bonds. But now having conversations, or not dismissing conversations, about direct monetizing, the Reserve Bank directly funding government borrowing. Are these the sorts of conversations we're going to have for the first time in 30 years, Cameron?
Well, we're having those conversations at the moment. I'd like to see us go down, but yeah, the Reserve Bank's got a balance sheet. Yeah, they are deploying that balance sheet. They've bought a bucket load of government bonds already off the secondary market in the past couple of weeks. Yeah, they've pledged to buy up around $30 billion. Yeah, they're looking at buying local government bonds as well. Yeah, they're trying to keep interest rates low right across the curve. That keeps the cost of capital down. Yeah, lower interest rate, we would kind of hope that's going to help foster a bit of a recovery up the other side. Is it going to be a big game changer? I think the answer is no, but it's going to help at the margin. Look, if I have a look at the government books, I think they're going to be an absolute disaster in the next 3 years. Yeah, we're leaning off the government balance sheet. In the near term, it's the right policy response because the government has got a big balance sheet. Yeah, they've been able to borrow. So we're putting a lot of money into the economy. It's the right policy response, but we go through a major economic shock, then by my calculations, the government revenue is going to be down about $40 to $50 billion over the next 5 years relative to what they're expecting in the half year economic and fiscal update. Now, I think they're going to need to be pushing up to about $50 billion worth of new expenditure into the system over the coming sort of couple of years. So all you got there, we've got an additional $100 billion worth of borrowing. What does that mean? Government debt is going to be moving up to well in excess of 50% of GDP. We have not seen those sort of debt levels in New Zealand since 1990, 1991. Globally, that's not overly high for a government, but it is really high for a country that's got the level of private sector debt such as New Zealand. So the rating agencies are going to have a damn good look at that. And New Zealand's going to have to go through one almighty period of fiscal consolidation on the other side. We're going to have to get the books back in good order. What is that going to mean? Once we get into recovery mode, there's going to be less capacity for the government to spend. Maybe the government's got to flog off a few assets, look at their own balance sheets. That'll be politically difficult, almost impossible to achieve. Or the lever they are likely to pull, and you see it sticking out a mile, they will increase taxes on the other side. So brace, I suspect, for the top marginal income tax rate to go up, or else they'll bring in another marginal top-tier tax rate that's got a six-figure income in front of it, and we'll get socked on that. But no illusions, we're going to pay for this stuff on the other side.
Adrian, what is the issue with directly monetising debt, which is essentially Reserve Bank printing money and lending it to government? Government spends on big infrastructure projects. Is it the spectre of inflation that people under a certain age have probably never experienced? But is that the concern if that model is used and not used carefully? Sorry, Cameron.
Well, there's a whole lot of concerns. People make the analogy, the comparison to countries such as Zimbabwe. It's not exactly comparison if you like to think about. There is the risk of inflation down the track. The more you print, the more the potential is that your currency just keeps on going down out of his fear. I don't think that's going to take place in the current world because everybody's printing money. So it's almost like a race where you can't get to the bottom. But if you sit back and you think about what central banks are doing around the globe or the extraordinary policy response or who gets the benefits of this stuff, your quantitative easing, all these sort of fancy terms, what are they hellishly good for in the first instance? They're good for asset prices. What have we seen in the past few weeks? Equities have gone back up the stairs after shooting down the elevator. Now, equities have gone back up the stairs because the system's been flushed with liquidity. What are we still seeing around the globe at the moment? Unemployment is rising. So we've got this gap here between Wall Street, the owners of capital, versus Main Street, the ordinary bloke in the street that's sort of losing their job. We could see the same sort of danger here in New Zealand if, ample liquidity. Imagine if ample liquidity, sees the housing market down temporarily, but the housing market is right back up again in 2021 and unemployment rate is still high. You start to think about the pressure, the fallout we're going to see out of that on the other side, and all of a sudden you've got some real destructive pressure that's going to get pushed towards the model we've had for a long time in the form of capitalism.
All right. If I could bring in both Eric and Andy quickly on this idea of funding this debt differently and monetizing it, essentially.
Yeah.
Your views, Eric.
Look, away you go, Eric.
Sure. So long as they don't do too much of it, it isn't terrible. So on the balance sheets, it'll look no different than open market operations where they're buying government bonds in the secondary markets. The problem you'd have is if they decide to start canceling government debt that's held on the Reserve Bank's books. And that's where you start getting into real problems. The political economy worry that you also have is that when the bank is just buying up the debt that the government is issuing, you're not really having that debt in a market anymore. You start losing pricing on it, and you can start losing discipline on the government side because they don't see a price for putting up that debt anymore. So I would prefer that the bank did find ways of getting into the negative interest rates that you will see in other places than pushing towards directly buying government debt.
Andy.
So Catherine, the first thing I'd do is just focus on getting the economy going. That's the most important thing. Second thing I'd do is establish a public-private sector partnership and probably appoint a private sector CEO of that agency to get our economy going. I'd reform the banking sector. I'd turn New Zealand into a giant investment fund. I'd establish a safety net for people losing jobs. And then I'd really think more broadly about infrastructure. Infrastructure not only for physical facilities, but going digital, going e-commerce, enabling startups to come out of all these people are unemployed. What is going to happen is when the universities and the government start making people redundant, which is coming, we are going to be in a pile of stuff that's happening if we don't do something different.
All right. So what are you going to do differently first to support those losing jobs? Do you want to see some benefit increases? Do you want to see abatement rates, scrap for a time? What do you want to see?
Well, I think the gap, the only way people are surviving on the wage subsidy right now is because people are just accepting that for a period of time. The short answer is, I think there's actually about a 30% turnover typically in the employed workforce every year. So we're actually quite a highly mobile workforce. We just need people to have enough money to be able to get through while they look for new jobs. And I just think it's that social policy as well, because the volume of people losing their jobs is going to be so big. But
how do you do it, Andy? Do you use this to bring in a living wage, for example? And again, the problem with that is that cost goes back onto a business. Yeah. Do you just boost benefits, which again is the taxpayer paying and adding to that debt, but it's cutting out the business? Just boost benefits.
Why not?
Because people on benefits spend.
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
For a period of time.
You also said get the government, get the economy going again. That's what everyone wants to do. But what's the short-term injection options? What do you make of the helicopter money? Does it go into the savings accounts of the well-off, or does it get spent?
I don't like the helicopter money side of things. I think we need to be quite targeted around how we fuel and support the productive economy. We've got to be careful around picking winners, but also we've got a balance sheet as a country. Why not use that in a more aligned way to back some of the best companies that actually are creating jobs And why is it wrong that the government or we as New Zealanders own a portion of the best companies for a period of time? Because we need to make money while it's costing us so much on the other side.
Does that include construction companies at the moment that are under pressure, missing staff, missing income and with big projects incomplete? If it came to that, would you say that?
That starts to get way more challenging when you start to think about sectors and businesses. But, you know, philosophically, we need to come together and go, we are a company or a whānau of community. Now, how can we back the best and support the ones that are suffering to get through?
Eric, how do you pick the best is another one, but let's just hear from you on what your proposals would be for that injection.
Sure. I'd be looking, rather than at benefit increases, which we've already had, to have an extension of the student loan scheme to non-students. This is something we'd pitched in a report about a month ago. What you could do, the reason for doing it is you can extend a whole pile more help to those who need it the most if you do it through loans rather than through broad-scale helicopter money. The student loan scheme, you can turn about $4.75 out for every dollar that you'd otherwise be distributing as helicopter money. You'd have people would be able to borrow up to the extent of their income loss, up to a cap at 0%, and then repay through the student loan scheme the same way that students already do. So that would be a nice way of running income support in a targeted way that would make sure that we can get it to those who need it most, and that has a bit of a repayment scheme built into it. I think the government should be looking at rate support. So rather than getting into some of the rental support that might make it harder for tenants to come to reasonable negotiations with their landlords, because if everybody's expecting that the government is going to backstop rents, then the landlords will take a bit of a tougher line in negotiating that way. We could be looking at instead having the government, for those companies that are eligible for the wage subsidy, helping to cover the rates bill so that local governments don't wind up in financial pressure where everybody's deferring their rates because they're in financial hardship. I think the government also should be looking at some of the costs that they have imposed through the minimum wage increases over time. Economists know that minimum wages that are high relative to median wages have severe unemployment effects in downturns. So they haven't had much effect during the long boom that we've had, or I don't know if you want to call it a boom, but it's been this long-standing expansion where we've had a fairly strong labor market. It's going to bind substantially on the downside. The government seems unwilling to knock back the minimum wage, and it's probably a bad idea right now anyways because you want to have some income support in there. But they should be looking at subsidies to business to cover some of the cost that the ramp-up in the minimum wage has caused so that people will be able to hire again, because you're in this horrible spot where everybody needs more income, but firms are finding workers a lot less productive because it's not that workers aren't working hard or anything. It's that the requirements of being at level 3 and level 2 and distancing and all of the other things that businesses have to do to operate safely means that each employee is generating a bit less revenue than they otherwise would have been. And if you're in that spot, combined with a very high real minimum wage, it gets really hard to keep workers on. And the wage subsidy scheme has helped to attenuate some of those problems for now. But as that wears out and we shift more towards loan support, we're going to have the government coming in a bit more to undo some of the damage it might have caused through those wage hikes.
Cameron, just very quickly, if you would, just very succinctly, what do you see? Because the big risk here, and it's been alluded to, is, you know, the collapse in demand that can come also when people are on benefits and when there's just a shortage of cash in people's pockets and you're into that ever vicious circle. Anything you would add on some immediate measures on that front?
No, it's not just that front. So if I think about what needs to happen on the other side of this, we're going to need to have a ruthless obsession, and I don't use that term lightly, with improving New Zealand's economic performance. Yeah, that is the way we're going to get people back into paid work. Now, this is not growth at any cost. It's about staying connected, the same sustainability team, this sort of thing. But if we've got an unemployment rate, 10 to 15%, you're going to see a Maori Pacific Island unemployment rate up around 25%. That's an absolute social disaster. What are we going to need? We're going to need to park some of the political ideology, We're going to have a ruthless obsession with all those little things, what's called microeconomics. All those levers we can pull to improve economic performance. We need to target the entrepreneurs, leverage New Zealand's brand, streamline the Overseas Investment Office, major changes in qualification. New Zealand's a wealthy country when it comes to renewable resources. Have a look at the opportunities in aquaculture. But the things are there. We're just going to need to deliver a plan, and we're going to need to execute around it. And credit to the government for their crisis management. It's been absolutely first class. But boy, are they going to need to come up with a credible plan on the other side, and they've got to have the ability to execute around that. And 2019 was not great for execution.
Thank you, all of you. Cameron Bagri, independent economist, Eric Crampton, chief economist of the think tank, the New Zealand Initiative, and Andy Hamilton, former chief executive of the Ice House, now director of its investment arm, as well as co-founder of the small business support platform, Manaaki.